the creature of you, the members, especially our guest commissioner for Nageda, and also our visitors. We have always with us the PMG. We're happy today to have Babu Mbatha in our midst. You are now like a guest member. You're nevertheless welcome. Members, we decided to call this meeting today in order to acquaint ourselves with the issues pertaining to the case against SACCO. We know it has now been concluded at the Constitutional Court, but it will be important that we get the whole background into the whole thing, and why did we get to where we are today, where we find ourselves, and what are the implications for the country. You know, SACCO used to be a state-owned entity before. It was privatized in the 90s, and it is international. Their investments are even to all other continents, if you were to look at continental investments. So it is our own baby in South Africa. That's why maybe so important that we understand SACCO. I'm told SACCO stands for South African Christian Coal. African. In English, it's just South African coal and oil. Established for the purposes of different purposes, and as it evolved, then it found itself having even more purpose. What we want to know from Mr. Bonagele, we all understand that in 2007 they got a directive, sort of. Would I say a directive, Mr. Bonagele, from the CTI? Was it a directive or a complaint? Let me put it as a complaint. Around two areas that were pricing related. As a result, they found themselves in also investigating the matter as put before them, because they found there was the basis for that kind of investigation. But it's not for me to give you that background. It is for the commission, because they've been practically involved and actually leading this particular case on excessive pricing against SACCO, and I would love them to really brief us on that. And without the waste of time, may I give the secretary, send in secretary, to give us apologies. I must indicate before I hand over to him that our secretary, Noluchane Skaka, her mother is not well. They just discovered that she has cancer, and she's hospitalized. But unfortunately, because the challenges of the beds and so forth, with a person in that state, you think it would be appropriate to prioritize and give her a bed, but she still doesn't have a bed. She had to be with her. We, from the human side, I think we do understand. We have Peter Paul here sending in for her. You realize we don't have agenda, because she had thought she'll be here. Unfortunately, she wasn't here, and we do not even have the agenda with us. But this is the only item we have today, and we'll accord the commission to that opportunity to do so after our secretary has done the apology.
Thank you, Chairperson. That there are no apologies received, and that's not recorded.
Thank you, Peter Paul. I think there are no apologies, meaning that people who are not here are absent. So may we then hand over to the Commissioner. But before you commence, let's appreciate your availability or you availing yourself for this meeting. We know that you are busy now with the health inquiry, and you're going to start here in the Western Cape after you've already started. Yes, I know, in the Western Cape. You've been in other provinces, you're 10 now in the Western Cape. You've got such a busy schedule, and we appreciate the fact that you could give us your time. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and I'm delighted myself to be here. This is of course, a very important case for us. I know it's important for you because it's very important for the country. The case briefing itself will be very short because I can just tell you that we have appealed, we have filed a notice to appeal the Competition Appeal Court decision before the Constitutional Court, and the Constitutional Court has turned us down. So if I was just talking about the court cases, that would be the end of the briefing. But I know, of course, this is a very intractable problem because this is where competition policy intersects very directly with industrial policy, and it therefore makes of a fairly complex set of circumstances, and I'm delighted to be discussing some of these with you. I'll talk about the development of the company, because I think it's quite important that we continuously remind ourselves as to where does this company come from. I'll also very briefly talk, I've got a table in my slides that summarizes all the investigations we've had against Sasol, and then I'll talk about the famous polymer case, and I'll close off with the impact assessment that we've done in the fertilizer cases that we had against Sasol as well. Now, Sasol, as we all know, was supported, owned, and controlled by the state since its establishment until it was privatized. And to some extent, even beyond the privatization stage, continued to receive state support. And we know also that this was due to the strategic nature of the company to South Africa, given the security of supply of fuel during the period of Russia. So the state ensured through legislation and regulation that Sasol was sustainable, profitable, and would not fail. The most significant legislative measures, I've done a summary here. The protection of synthetic industry was made a public policy by government, and this is the process of producing fuel from coal. An arrangement, you will recall, was made for Sasol's fuel products to make themselves into the retail sector. This was done through numerous ways, one of which was a requirement that all substations had to have a Sasol pump that was dedicated, and an offtake that all other oil companies were obliged to have for all of Sasol's production. This, in many ways, insulated Sasol from marketing risk because there was a market that was readily made available for it, or obviated the need to invest in a retail network. You will know that the retail network by Sasol is a relatively new feature made possible by an end to that agreement that ensured that each substation in Gauteng in the old Transvaal had a Sasol pump that was dedicated to retailing Sasol's fuel. This you would also find in rail equivalent tariff, which had the result of exempting Sasol from paying high transport costs that were applicable to everyone else. We also know that Sasol, together with other oil companies, utilize state-funded infrastructure such as the pipeline network. I make this point that this is only possible because the state forces the consumer to pay for the pipeline. So the pipeline transporting fuel from Durban to Johannesburg is in fact a subsidy by the South African consumer to the oil industry, because it is the levy, the petrol levy, that is imposed by government on oil petrol consumers, that then aids the transportation of fuel at almost no risk to the oil companies at all, which is in itself not a natural feature of the working market. And when Sasol was privatized, there was very minimum risk posed to investors because of all of this arrangement. At that time, again, I remind you that even the price at which it was privatized was significantly discounted, and the regulations at the time guaranteed its profitability on each segment of the value chain, such as the significantly discounted price, the actual risk exposure of private investors in respect of both Sasol 2 and 3 was very limited. I will now talk about Sasol Chemical Industries, which is separate from Sasol Oil. Sasol Oil is the biggest component of Sasol, but I think what we are concerned about today is what is called Sasol Chemical Industry, which is comprised of Sasol Polymers, Sasol Nitro, Sasol West, Sasol Solvent, and Infrachem. I mention these because these are the businesses that houses most of the basic chemicals that we've come to know as a key input to a lot of other further processes further down the main chain. I will not bore you through the detail of how it is structured internally, but I just want to make the point that Sasol Nitro houses a very important part of the business, which is Sasol fertilizer business, whose range includes ammonia nitrate derivative products. These are products that are used mainly for as an input to various fertilizer products mainly used for our staple foods such as maize and so on. Just to give you the breadth of our work in this involving this company, on fuels, we initiated a market inquiry in 2014, towards the end of 2014, which is still under investigation. This is the inquiry into the production and supply of LPG, the important gas that is a byproduct of refining operations. So obviously Sasol is one of the refiners and will be impacted by that. We've done a lot of work on fertilizer. We've looked at excessive pricing for ammonia. We've also looked at price fixing and market allocation arrangements. That cartel case, I think, was closed with a $250 million penalty and an admission of guilt. The abuse case was also settled with an agreement to exit the retail part of the business in fertilizer, except for a few plants that that they kept for defined purposes. I will discuss the outcome of this later in my presentation. And then there's the polymer sector, which is the subject of the case that I will also be discussing just now. Then there is the gas, what I call the gas sector, and this is separate from LPG. This is natural gas, methane gas and natural gas. We've done some cases on this. We've done a case involving Spring Life, which entered into an agreement, in fact, this was a baby agreement with Sasol, and we found that there was a restriction of the competition there in the form of collusion, and Spring Life was fine. We also looked at the case involving Sasol Gas and Egoli Gas, a very similar arrangement to Spring Life. We also found that this was, in fact, collusion. And these involved Sasol applying for leniency for entering into these collusive arrangements. That was just to give you a sense of the sort of our activities that involved this company. But now, just to come back to the polymers case, I don't intend to go through this slide precisely because we had presented them before the committee last time, but I've included them here as a background reading for members, but I'll be happy to take questions on them if and when necessary. So all of that background and what we found, I will not discuss. The only issue that I will emphasize is the impact of this as far as we're concerned to the plastic sector in South Africa. What we are arguing is the unfairness. I want to put the law aside now for a moment. What we are arguing is the unfairness of a low-cost producer that is able to produce polymers at lower cost due to our abundance of coal, because this is where this starts from. Our abundance of coal, and of course the technology that the company has to make fuel from that coal, makes it possible for it to be one of the lowest cost producers of polymers in the world. All we're saying is the practice of import parity oftentimes leads to South African firms, South African buyers, actually buying at prices that are higher than our competing countries, so countries that produce plastic products. Because import parity is based on how much you would have paid if you were to import the product. So, and the dynamics of this are such that if, for example, someone in another market is able to say, I would have bought this product at a 10% discount, their price will include the 10% discount because that's their import parity. So import parity doesn't suggest that these are the same prices globally, because it's about the best alternative for the buyer. If the buyer is able to get the product cheaper than they would, than the South African buyer is able to get. And we know that the South African buyer is always disadvantaged, sometimes due to our geographic location, because our transport costs are fairly high compared to many countries in Asia, for example. So, mainly in Asia, we're finding that prices for inputs are lower, both in steel and in plastic, are lower than we are able to import. So, import parity is a real disadvantage. This is not a smokescreen. It's a real disadvantage to people who use the products as an input. And there's been very little actually that's been discussed by the courts on impact, because the courts have concerned about themselves about the definition of excessive pricing. There's been very little, in fact, no attention at all by the Competition Appeal Court on the impact of this, because the impact has nothing to do with the case. Whether the price is formally described by a court as excessive or not is neither here nor there. The real issue is the impact of these prices on downstream industries. And that impact doesn't go away. Whether the commission loses the case, whether it wins, the issue is, as long as we have these prices, we are going to continue to this problem. I have previously shown a slide that shows the decline of the sector since about 2001. This is the period that coincides exactly with a change in Sasol's pricing strategy. This is when they started charging import parity. You can see the plastic sector declining and imports of plastic products increasing, as well as jobs declining with the sector. This is a this debate. I'm not just saying it in Parliament. This is the same debate that we want to have. We continuously have with Sasol through the cases that we do. So in court, outside court, this is the real issue. I just want to draw attention, as I conclude this point about impact, that we have various strategies that involve plastic as an input. One of them is the auto sector. We're pumping a lot of money into the auto sector because that's, we're saying this is where jobs are. When polypropylene is mainly used by the automotive converter to produce the heavy components. The impact of this is our competitiveness in the auto sector depends in part on the cost of input into plastic. If we cannot make plastic products competitively, there is a very real risk that a lot of sectors, and I'm using the auto sector as an example, a lot of sectors are going to be uncompetitive. This is not just an issue of people making consumer products of lower value. This involves strategic sectors in the economy that are at the heart of our economic survival as a country. As I indicated, I don't intend to talk about the case itself. Just again to take members through the history briefly. We had this excessive pricing case successfully prosecuted at the tribunal, was overturned at the Competition Appeal Court, and our attempts to have it, to appeal it before the Constitutional Court were unsuccessful. The next logical question, of course, is what then will happen from now. We have an ongoing investigation in the sector. We are looking at that carefully in light of the Competition Appeal Court judgment, because that judgment is now precedent. We want to step up our engagement with the sector, which involves both Sasol and its customers who buy these products from the downstream manufacturers. We are hoping to get an initiative here quite soon, which will look once again on this issue of impact and whether there are any agreements that we are able to reach with regards to prices in view of our ongoing investigations. The last thing, obviously, is we continue to advocate to various stakeholders, including government, that we need to have a watchful eye into the sector, because this, as I said, involves an intersection of competition and industrial policy. So we are also looking at whether there is any industrial policy action that can be taken to rein in this kind of behavior, focusing on the outcomes. So those engagements are also ongoing. Now, just very briefly on the fertilizer, perhaps this is one of the positive stories we can take out of the cases that we've had. And I indicated this case was involving Sasol as well as its competitors fixing the price of fertilizer, and ended with an admission by Sasol and the payment of a fine. But the most important structural change occasioned by the agreement was Sasol agreeing to divest or discontinue its operations at retail level. Because the biggest problem was Sasol was a seller of the input into blending. Fertilizers suppliers blend a lot of fertilizers. And the key input for maize production is ammonia that we have in the country. We import some urea from outside, but really it's ammonia we have here, and it's difficult to import urea. So Sasol is a seller of ammonia, so if it's active at a retail level, it's able to favor its own operations downstream and squeeze everybody else out. And one of the structural conditions was therefore for it to exit the retail sector so that it can apply everybody fairly. And we have then gone back to look at the impact of that in the sector, because the principle is very similar. Honourable members will recall that we have discussed before the statement that we also had with Telco. The settlement is very similar to this, because what you want is a firm that's dominant. In the case of Telkom, you dominate in infrastructure. And so the downstream operations, so people who connect internet to homes, are dependent on Telkom infrastructure. And what you heard was Telkom favoring its own downstream operations, even when they were inefficient. And the agreement there was to allow everybody to buy the infrastructure on non-discriminatory terms. That's a similar thing that we did. Allow everybody to buy on non-discriminatory terms, remove unfair discounts. In addition, yes, that's all agreed to exit. What we have found so far is a bit encouraging. One of the former cartel members, Omnia, invested $1.4 billion in a new nitric acid plant upstream, and again, this is a new investment. It never would have been possible with the cartel, because the cartel was such that Omnia was not going to increase its capacity, because the whole point of the cartel was to restrict output. But we have also not seen greenfield entry, which is the point we are a little bit concerned about because of the capital requirement. But where it's been quite exciting is downstream. So the guys who are traders, the guys who are blending fertilizer, they buy different products from everybody, and they supply farmers, they support farmers. We've seen a lot of activity there. Prophet was initially a complainant, so we've seen a lot of growth. DWK and Kynoch, they've all entered blending businesses, and they have acquired some Sasol divested plants. We've seen a lot of new entrants coming in, and we think the market is fairly competitive and on the right path. We've also seen Omnia increasing its ammonia imports, again something that we think was not possible with cartel. And most of this is used internally. The agreement was that they were always going to be getting their supply from Sasol. We have spoken to farmers, and they confirm that they now have more options, and they improve access to the products. There's increased participation by a lot of smaller blenders and traders. So that I think just to end on a positive note is the story on fertilizer. I must emphasize on fertilizer that our work is still not yet over, because this is just but one product, because this is just focusing mainly on products that are produced by soil, and that's largely ammonia. So I don't want to come out here having said fertilizer prices are down and it's all heaviness. I think there are many other areas that we're still doing work on as a commission involved in fertilizer. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Babu Bonahead. Colleagues, this is not the first time we've been briefing on the special case. And I'm happy that the commission has gone beyond in terms of the notes provided and beyond what was expected. It is important, therefore, that we also from time to time visit their website as we indicated before. What is encouraging is that, yes, you in life you don't win everything. What is important is that the fight continues, because all what the competition authorities are acknowledging is the fact that they will not stop fighting until the fight of our people or the fight of our people is realized. Actually, it's totally looked at by everyone in South Africa, whether public, private, or otherwise. We need to attend to the people's plight, and we cannot be ignorant. We cannot also afford to be negligent on that. So we want to thank the work that you're doing, Babu Bonahead. It's quite clear that it's not an easy thing, and the fact that you are looking at transformation issues, you are looking at also issues that indirect on our people, is quite humbling. We really appreciate that, and from the chair's table, with the support of the committee, obviously, I know that they will continue to support you whenever you do the right thing. The fact that you fall a bit doesn't mean you lost the battle. It means you must go back and re-look at other strategies. And I really appreciate your spirit in the fact that you're concerned. Members, this is the presentation before us. Total emancipation of our people depend on how we do things. It has nothing to do with ideology, it has everything to do with how best do we make their living better, and how best we alleviate their challenges in a life living concerns. So that's what I want to put before you. If you have any questions, this is the time to pose those questions. If you have any comment, this is the time. That is it.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Obviously, we thank the Commissioner for the presentation, but obviously, we are traumatized by the report, Chairperson. The facts of the matter indicate that in this particular case, a company that came into being through the resources of the state has now become so huge that it is now feeding, you know, on the same citizens whose money is brought it into being. It's a very sad situation. But as you are indicating, Chair, we are encouraged by the fact that the Competition Commission is fighting on regardless. They'll be engaging, they are continuing to engage us all, and its customers, the entire industry, to try and find whatever scraps and so on that they can get out of this giant that is now feeding on the people who brought it into being. But I'm just trying to check. I would like the commissioner to indicate to us the new direction that they're taking, you know, going straight into the industry and trying to, you know, win over these people and so on. In terms of the law, is there any opportunity in terms of the law that you could go back, use different circumstances to restart the case and go back to the Constitutional Court? Is that possible? Or if you are turned down once, then that is the end of the case. If we could get that dynamic. But we are encouraged by the fact that you are involving all the players in the industry to try and salvage whatever that you can salvage. And we thank you very much for the fighting spirit, because these are the type of institutions that government needs, a progressive government like ours, to try and fight the battle, you know, of small people, small companies.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Senator Kiani. Dr. Kai? Thank you. Commissioner, we know that the Competition Act prohibits dominant firms from charging excessive prices to different consumers, but it seems that the Commission has historically had difficulty in successfully prosecuting these cases that do involve excessive pricing. The Mittal case from 2008 is another example that comes to mind, and I want to know what are the reasons for that. I was interested to read the comments of Judge Dennis Davis, who pointed out in the Competition Appeal Court's ruling that these excessive prices cases are so difficult to decide because there's no generally accepted criterion for determining if a price is excessive or not. Sometimes high prices are necessary to recover large upfront costs, and that any policy on excessive pricing is likely to yield incorrect predictions. And finally, even if courts find the firm guilty of excessive pricing, finding an effective remedy to the contravention is difficult. So given Judge Davis's observations in that regard, and also given the fact that I think it was you who said after the Constitutional Court refused leave to appeal, that the Commission would be going, quote, back to the drawing board to determine your approach to handling excessive pricing complaints going forward, can you give us some idea of what exactly those drawing board thoughts and conversations are and how you plan to tackle this matter? Then secondly, I wondered, given that you're here, whether I couldn't deeply ask a question on another matter pertaining to the SAB Miller Coca-Cola deal. And I'm curious to know why it's taken the Competition Commission so long to investigate the merger between SAB Miller Coca-Cola's bottling assets and the merger with the Gucci family interest to create Coca-Cola Beverages Africa, when my understanding is that the regulatory hurdles have been gotten through in other countries. Is it a result of intervention by Minister Patel? And what does the series of delay mean for the SAB InBev deal? What are your projected timeframes for assessing that proposed merger, and what kind of conditions are you considering imposing? Thanks.
Thanks, Dr. Kyler. I would really want to defend the Commissioner here. That's not the latter part of your question, not part of today's agenda, and therefore I'm not going to allow the Commissioner to respond to that. Today we are about the first one, okay? And we're going to confine ourselves within that. Babu Bata?
Thanks, Jack. Thank you very much for the presentation, Commissioner. My interest is on the latter part of your input, where you say in your round of, I would call it, assessment with the previous users and the affected parties, you established that they were fairly comfortable with the chain of events, some of them. Now, unfortunately, in the South African environment, some of us will forever ask questions that pertain to those ones that said they were fully compatible with the turn of events. It might have been that they were fairly established and quite easily able to manage the spread of cost and embracing also of the new results of the turn of events. My worry is, what then happened to those who start afresh, and in particular, since this is a highly costed type of businesses to be involved in, how many of those that you think will be able to join in, and they are mostly of a different kind as a result of this turn of events? Do you see this turn of events in the downstream embracing of other new players spreading across all color lines? Because at the end of the day, these opportunities are the result of these discoveries. They must create opportunities for our people to start and getting in, either in small, you know, ventures or whatever. But it seems to me that the fertilizer companies in South Africa, you either have the bigger ones or the middle ones. But we hardly detect the small players, the guys who just do the normal things.
Thank you, Lombard. Any other questions? All right. I just want to find out if there are any policy gaps that you think as a committee would perhaps want us to look at as a committee. Especially you referred to the link between the industrial policy and the competition policy, which played itself in this case that you lost with the Constitutional Court. Can we then get as to what exactly can we? You also continued actually to look at the failure of not only our cause, but rather everybody to understand the difference between the impact and some of the of the excessive pricing vis-a-vis ordinary understanding of excessive pricing that is related to definition of that. How do you think we could assist as a portfolio committee in making your work a bit more easier, so that as you go through this, I think we won't have a problem of having to be sort of disadvantaged by the very same policies or legal documents that you're supposed to be using as your platform for implementation. I just want to find out on that. I hope my question is quite clear now. Because we can't just look at you doing that without looking at our role as the legislators. How can we assist also on that? That would be my question. If there are any other afterthoughts questions, please post them now. Otherwise, after the response, I'm going to close. Thank you very much. May we then give the commissioner the opportunity to respond.
Thank you, Chair. Many of the questions are related, because they are about what becomes way forward. So I will deal with that. Maybe before I do, I'll quickly respond to this question posed by Honorable Mata about the others being happy. I was referring specifically to fertilizer, not in general. In fertilizer, in ammonia in particular, there has been a major change, and we have done the study looking at the dynamics of competition since our intervention. Because some of the criticism sometimes is that we intervene and then we never look back. So we went back to look at what happened since Sasol's exit of the retail sector, and we have confessed that the sector has become much more dynamic than a lot of SMMEs that have entered. But I think there is still a big challenge of transformation in South Africa, and I think you are right that the fertilizer sector is one of those sectors where you still see a dominance of a particular section of the population. So that I cannot deny. But the opportunities, I think they are opening up spaces more and more. The financial institutions themselves and entrepreneurs are supposed to take up the challenge, because the difficulty with us is we create space, we create the platform, but we don't pick who must get in. So we can't go and pick so and so and say get into the sector. We can create space and open opportunities. And unless, you know, we have those conditions where ourselves are directly involved, let's say if a diversity in a merger, sometimes we can be involved in approving the buyer, but primarily that's not the work of the competition agents to pick winners. I recognize though the transformation issue, I think it's well named. The issue of about what we can do now. Firstly, on Honorable Siane's question of what happened to the case itself, we have an existing investigation. So sometimes we are lucky enough to have this situation where we have more than one investigation on the go. So this was the case with us all. We have an investigation covering a different period of time. The facts are very similar to the previous case. But obviously we now have to move very carefully about that case. And I will not be able to discuss the rest of the strategy because that was represented here. So, but that case is there and they know about it. And we'll see how we proceed. And that's part of going back to the drawing board, by the way, is go back to that case and decide what we do about it. The other area which is related to the chair's question is about what's the way forward now on matters of interpretation of the law and perhaps how the law is currently worded. We think that indeed there's a role here for the there's a possibility here for relooking at the legislation. We have raised this issue with EDG, in particular the minister. I know that they are working on this as well. I think the wording in our legislation can be improved. If all is going to be rare to prosecute people for excessive pricing, so we're not envisaging that every day the commission is going to have an excessive pricing case, because, you know, to attack somebody for charging the price is not an easy thing, because everybody is free to charge the price they want. We only intervene in cases of really excessive prices that are inducing some sense of shock. For us, we look at the impact as well. We think it's quite important that we look at what the effects is one of the things that the law requires us to do, but I think it's also just an important thing to do. So we're always going to have a few excessive pricing cases, but we want to choose them carefully. It might be cases with a real impact. It tends to be cases where there is a dominant supplier of a key input which is used in other sectors of the economy. So we've had excessive pricing now in cases like steel, we've had excessive pricing now here on plastics. So it's sectors like that where there is a key industrial input. And I'm not defending that there could not be excessive pricing in other sectors, but all I'm saying is there are always going to be few excessive pricing cases. And it's not a uniquely South African situation. This, I mean, the other jurisdictions as well have very few excessive pricing cases. It's a tool that competition authorities have. It's been used in Europe quite a bit. It's not been used that much in the United States, but everybody recognizes that it's one of the tools in the armory that one can pull in the event of a clear market problem. I think, having said that, we all acknowledge that some of the wording and the definitions in the Act do need to change, but I leave that for further engagement, perhaps with Minister Patel, who is handling that. On what could be further done, there is obviously a need to continuously look at the capacity of the competition authority. You know, I don't want to sit here and be defensive. I think because of the complexity of these cases, we ought to continuously, not just us at the Commission, but I think even yourselves as people who have oversight over us, we constantly have to look at whether the Commission does have the adequate capacity to be able to undertake these types of prosecutions. I think we have done fairly well with the resources we've got and the capacity we have. But this is also one of the issues I raised with the Minister, that I think that we ought to be re-looking, because we're not saying we will be able to match the private sector, because they spend a lot of money on this sort of thing, lawyers and so on. So, I mean, we're not suggesting that you must have five advocates appearing in one case as they would have. But we have to make sure that at least there is parity of us so that you can have a fair fight. That's also another debate. I'm responding to your question about what else can be done. I think what also can be done in terms of the policy gaps is really to industrial policy, you know, is full of incentives for people to behave in a particular way. And I think, you know, and I say this without knowing that I'm not a policy maker, but there are certain things that I think need to be given some teeth. So, for example, if you identify particular products that as a country you have, and we've seen this discussion in mining, you know, the whole issue around beneficiation in mining is about restricting exports and saying, keep a portion of what you produce for local beneficiation. That's what is happening in around the beneficiation debate. And that's industrial policy, because you say you want to use your natural endowment to promote certain industries. And I think a debate like that one in industrial sectors like this is also important. So I think policymakers need to have this debate about key inputs. That debate, I think, can be had fairly, because what gives them these advantages is not just government support, as I have narrated in the case of Sasol, but natural endowment. It's coal that gives these benefits. So I think there could be a discussion around how we beneficiate coal and what happens downstream as we beneficiate coal. Because what Sasol does is beneficiation of coal, which I think is a very good thing. But what are the benefits that various sectors that are linked to coal should be benefiting, I think is a debate, very important policy debate we need to have, especially in the context of what further investments need to be done in refining, because there's a big debate about the next refinery, because our refineries are old. So if you're going to expand refining capacity, what happens to the byproducts, which is an industry in itself, because the polymer industry and other industries are as a result of investment in refining capacity. And in our case, it happens to be coal refining, which has got all of these benefits. I think that's an industrial policy question. I think, Chair, lastly, I think that the issue of regulating some of the products should also not be put off the table. So, in this country, we regulate the price of petrol, the fixed price, because we care about security of supply as well as jobs. And if we care about jobs in the sector, and if we care about jobs in the public sector and growth of that sector, I don't think the issue of regulation should ever be put off the table, because it's the only credible lever that governments have over the private sector. The private sector, if you don't own it, you regulate it. So I think the issue of us always having to fight about prices of certain key products for our industrialization, one of the things that I think we should never do is to take off the table the issue of regulating the price. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair, one again. I don't know if you looked at other the practice elsewhere where you have a private company which used to be a public company. In terms of how are they regulated, because obviously if you used to be a public company, you stand it as an advantage, because you'll find that the legislation policy favor you because everything has been created for you, because you used to be owned by, you know, by the public then. And I think it should be a learning curve where government wants to privatize, for instance. Because if we have companies that we feel that they should be more understanding towards the public, behaving in a manner that is not even not beneficial towards the public, it becomes a challenge. But it would not be fair also to say that without having, you know, any shared experience elsewhere, where we can say, for instance, in country one, this used to be a case, and now the case is handled in this manner, so that we are able to, and then we look at also other areas that could perhaps motivate for or against us. So I think if that is done, as also policymakers and legislators, it would make it even much easier for us to, maybe something that we can give to our officials to look at, but at the same time look at that. But if you have an already existing case study around that, maybe you could share with us, because these things do help, especially in a country like ours, which is still in issue. I don't know if you had an answer on that now, but if you do not, maybe it's something that we can look at as a committee going forward, so that we can also assist in the upcoming amendments of your act, and also in implementing some of our existing policies, especially in relation to the new growth path and then the IPEP also. Because obviously the NTP would be a beneficiary of the implementation of the two.
Chair, it's an area we have not done much work on. What comes to mind are a few examples. Myself, in the telecommunications sector, for example, there is international practice of breaking down the former state-owned monopolies. This has happened in the United Kingdom with the sector regulator. I think that people adopt various strategies depending on a particular sector and what they want to achieve. So in telecoms, for example, size may be a big problem. If you are vertically integrated, you are in infrastructure, and you are also providing retail services. So I think it's one of the studies one can look at. In China, it's largely, these are not formally state-owned, they're still state-owned, but they get a lot of state support, they get a lot of cheap money from the state. And in return, China imposes export duties on their producers so that they can first meet the domestic requirements before exporting. And the duties are removed once they know that their local industries are able to be competitive at those sort of prices that their producers would be able to fetch from exports. So there are a couple of policy sort of options that different regulators and governments use. But I take the challenge that we will look more closely as well to these examples.
Thank you, Babonele. Ngiyathemba ngalo mzuzu sifanele ukubonga. May we use this opportunity to thank the Commissioner for the briefing and see passion whenever I talk about issues of competition. And above that, I think I also see passion whenever he talks about, you know, the impact that we have on an ordinary South African. We need such public servants, and we really are fortunate to have people like you. Thank you very much, and wish you all the best in the work that you're doing. It's not an easy one, you know. Sometimes investigating big companies, you know, you think that you think of your safety, you think of all other things. But I'm happy that in South Africa we are still protected, even by the law. So, as I said, good luck, because the work ahead is quite huge. We still have a long way to go in transforming our economy. So you are one of that institutions, or those institutions, that if doing your work as diligent as you're doing it, might see, you know, South Africa turning into a better country, better than what it is now. Thank you very much. All members, thank you for your attendance and also your participation. We will still meet next week after our program. We have next week the department coming to present to us their second and third quarter reports. So we'll be looking at that. We hope that will come prepared next week. We are aware that we still have the last quarter to look at. But that won't happen before we go on the next break.
Sure.
Okay, yes. Is that Babu Mbasa?
Yes. Can I just check something? Can we sign something that we attended? Because
The next thing will be dumping on top of the podium in that house saying I'm always absent. This is the second time I'm attending a meeting and there's no register. I'm concerned because I spend my time here, Jane.
You know why? You know why I'm smiling?
I'm attending, Chief.
You know why I'm smiling? Because you attended today, you are really making noise. Yes, Babu Mbatha, I did explain maybe before you came in. Can you drop something? Yeah, I did mention our challenge of today, but in the minute, we'll ensure that we have everyone. I think I spoke about Babu Mbatha a lot today, that your presence will really be noted. If it's not noted, then I'll know that the secretary has a problem with you in particular. But we are always fair. If you attend, we'll give you a note to that, but if you don't attend, unfortunately we're not going to. And if you're honest to yourself, you'll also acknowledge that. Because we can't say you did something that you didn't do. That I know for sure. But it's also an opportunity to look inward also. Because sometimes when you are called to order, you tend to look outward instead of looking inwards. You must also have an opportunity to say, is it really what I'm doing? Then let me change. It's very important. It's too late for change. Okay, after you, change is something that must acknowledge yourself that you want to do. If you can't, then it's up to you. You are the owner of yourself, nobody else. So, colleagues, thank you very much. Can we then adjourn the meeting for today? Thank you.